You are listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church, located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to westhill.net/donate.
We wish to acknowledge that we are on the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nation lands, which lands were previously occupied by the Seneca and Huron-Wendat First Nations. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Welcome on this very snowy morning, as it's turning out to be. Truth and Reconciliation Call to Action. Each week, in order to remain aware of our treaty obligations and the relationship we have with our First Nations sisters and brothers, we read one of the 94 recommendations sent to all levels of government by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We expect to complete these readings in June 2017. Recommendation 75. We call upon the federal government to work with provincial, territorial, and municipal government, churches, Aboriginal communities, former residential school students, and current landowners to develop and implement strategies and procedures for the ongoing identification, documentation, maintenances, commemoration, and protection of residential school cemeteries or other sites at which residential school children were buried. This is to include the provision of appropriate memorial ceremonies and commemorative markers to honor the deceased children in this or time of need. Love abound.
Grounded, guided, growing. A time for centering. From Scott Kearns.
In the sense of interconnection that we stress here so much, and it hits me during the week so often, the news these days, far away can be so close on your screen right in front of you, and you're seeing and hearing people's situations that breaks your heart and you feel so helpless about. And those interconnections are some of those toughest ones to realize that the human race is the human family and our family is hurting in so many places. And then there's the other part. Greta and I were just talking about, if you're driven through an area where there's a lot of apartment buildings and you see floor after floor after floor and there's people living in every one of those little places and you don't know them, but they're part of the human race. And I love that idea of it being both staggeringly challenging that we are all connected and beautifully affirming, because I am not alone. I am connected to you. I'm part of this amazing family here and the whole world. We're also connected with people who stand with us during difficulties. And the choir is going to introduce a very short song, a beautiful song, written by the minister of music at the church called Southminster Steinhauer, which you have heard a great deal about because they've been one of the more vocal sister churches with us from Edmonton, Alberta. And in this month's Observer, you'll see an article written by the senior minister, Nancy Steeves, on why a church that centers purely on values is not simply another service club, but something that actually nurtures and holds up these values and urges all of us to live by them, which you can then go out and do in service clubs as well, which isn't saying they're not communities, they're all communities. So we're going to introduce this song of connection about the earth being our home. The choir is going to introduce it here, and then we're going to invite you to learn it, and we'll use it in our sharing time from now on. Not every time, just...
Ancient atoms, arranged and reformed, connect us and bind us with the stuff of the stars. When all is over, our substance return to our element's birthplace, our atom's next tune. There are two readings this morning. The first one is taken from Noam Spencer, who's a PhD and author of the novel The Good Psychologist. He was born and raised on an Israeli kibbutz, and he's a professor of psychology at Otterbein University in Ohio, also a practicing clinician who specializes in the treatment of anxiety disorders. And he writes, "The frame, the definition, is a type of context. And context, as we have said before, determines the meaning of things. There is no such thing as the view from nowhere, or from everywhere for that matter. Our point of view, biases or observation, consciously and unconsciously. You cannot understand the view without the point of view." The next reading is from Lauro Martins, the author of Fire in the City, Savonarola, and the Struggle for Renaissance Florence. He is a scholar on the history of Renaissance Italy. And he writes, "It follows that the one thing we should not do to the men and women of past time, and particularly if they ghost through us, to us as larger than life, is to take them out of their historical context. To do so is to run the risk of turning them into monsters, whom we can denounce for our frequently political motives, an insidious game, because we are condemning in their makeup that which is likely to belong to a whole social world, the world that helped to fashion them, and that is deviously reflected or distorted in them. Censure of this sort is the work of petty moralists and propagandists, not historians, often as wisdom for the journey. May we walk in its light.
Focused Moments from Greta Vosper.
Those of you who have been following what it is we're doing know that we're in the third week of our Academy Awards series, and the movie that we're focusing on today is Moonlight. And so, of course, that influenced the writing of the focus moment this morning, both the idea of Moonlight and the theme of the movie. No, that's happening before the perspectives. This is the focus moment. Thank you. Sorry, it's not on the sheet. I do know that. I've written it down here. See, trailer. Got it. I've missed it every time Peter has the trailer queued up, and I've walked right over it. So thank you for calling that out. Under the circumstance of Moonlight, red disappears first. Yellow is gone. And green turns to shades of gray or ripples into a black no conifer has ever been. I know it's green. I know the birdhouse swinging from its branch is red. I know the finches gathered early at the feeder are yellow, dulled as they are in winter's plumes. Still, as I gaze upon a changed and blue-lit world, I hold these truths within me. So why is it I cannot hold to other truths that time to time are hidden too by circumstances, that cast them into this same and changing light, flattening the spectrum from multi-hued and wondrous to a cold and hard insistent light? Why can I not see beauty still in hearts grown cold, or dreams that withered long ago? Why am I so quick to see the depth of anger in this circumstantial light and not the love that spoke just yesterday, or the invitation that might take me back to wonder? Why do I insist the moonlight prism that robs him and her and him of the miracle of childish wonder, of youth and hope, and wants to be, is the truth that stands before me. We were all wonder once, riding the chariots of our father's arms by day, braving the night, safe twixt the castles of our mother's breasts. We cast the trees as our companions and bade them witness our grandest schemes. We yearned for affirmation. It bent and teased our being toward its singular hue, the kaleidoscopes that once defined us bleeding out, till all is lit like moonlight and its cold and hard insistent blue. Don't forget. Don't forget.
Thank you.
I'm not supposed to do my on. Thank you. They got it. Thanks. It's a powerful movie, and what we've experienced here has been powerful this morning so far. And when I started preparing for this, the theme I pulled out of it was context is everything. The reading from the historian who's talking about Florence, in as we study things as historians, we look back, and it's important for us not to drag people into our present day and condemn them for the realities that we understand now, but to let them sit in their context and try to understand what that context was. And similarly, it's not okay for us to take people from other contexts in the world or even in other neighborhoods in our city and drag them into our context and judge them based on our own understandings, because we don't get it. We don't get what Florence was like in the 1500s, and we don't get what it is around the corner in another world we've never been. But as I was moving through the week, it came to me that the things that we're experiencing, the tragedies that are happening in the world and the challenges and the people who are standing up to them, are asking us to look at something different. And so I have a couple of little exercises I want you to help me with here. The first one is about the Super Bowl, sort of, but not really. It just happens to be on today. But I wanted you to tell me what things you turn to for entertainment. What entertains you? Like when you've got a whole weekend ahead of you and you want to plug in some entertainment, what will it be? What do you look for? A hockey game? Something in nature? Sport? Some more sports? Historical fiction? Fiction, period. The broad scope of fiction. Friends? And good times? Music? I'm sorry? Strip wallpaper? Okay, yes? A walk in the woods, a good meal, cooking a good meal for you. Yes, it's not just eating it, it's cooking it. So those are the ways that we do entertainment. We find all kinds of ways to entertain ourselves. Gardening is one of the things that I like to do, and reading fiction, and, you know, all kinds of things that bring joy to me and pass the time. So if you were going to take in something to do with art, what would it be? When was the last time you went someplace to engage it? Go to a gallery? Mm-hmm. Concert? Okay. Paint a picture? Woodworking? Wallpaper? Photography. Good. What do you think is the difference between those two? What's the difference between art and entertainment? I'm sorry? Okay. More passive than active? Art is more active. I'm sorry? Oh, entertainment can be interactive as well, yes, okay. Yeah, like video games and things like that are sort of interactive. But that wouldn't be art, that would be entertainment. Right. Did everyone hear that? Something that hits that gong in the center of your being and makes it rain or makes it chime. Yes.
Both very subjective.
Both very subjective. Mm-hmm. Yes, the things that different people picked up about what they do for entertainment, very different. But if you all went through the same exhibit at a gallery, you may have very different reactions to it. It's very subjective. So the purpose of entertainment would be pass the time to have fun, distract from reality. Sorry? To relax, right? To manage your nervous system, says the psychotherapist, yes? Mm-hmm. Someone else said something over here. I missed it. Okay. And what is the purpose of art? It's kind of a trick question, because lots of people say there is no purpose to art. So
art is
yes.
It's an expression. Enlightenment.
A good source of conversation.
A good source of conversation, yes. Yes. A.C. Grayling, the philosopher, says there is no purpose to art. It can do a number of things. It can enlighten us. It can enrage us. It can convict us. It can call us to political action. It can do all kinds of things. But it doesn't have to have a purpose. Like, it is an end in and of itself. And that end, sometimes, although an artist may be trying to get you to do all of those things, an artist makes art because they feel compelled to do so. And so what is the result of that is there in and of itself. And we can explore, perhaps, what it is the artist was trying to do. What were they trying to get you to feel or see or do? Or we could explore what compelled the artist to create the art that that artist brought into being. Similarly, music. The same sort of creative force compels a composer as well. I remember when Isaac, our son, was thinking about going into art school, and I was really troubled about that because I had never seen art crawl out of him. I felt that if an artist had art screaming to get out, and I'd never seen that in Isaac because I, you know, didn't realize that, you know, a phlegmatic artist doesn't scream anything. But he's now a very competent artist and good at his craft. But I think that the movie Moonlight is not entertainment. How many of you have seen Moonlight? How many of you were entertained? Okay, good. One of you saw it as entertainment. How many of you came out thinking, why did I do that? Okay. why did I do that? Yes. Yeah, it was a challenging film. Because it wasn't entertainment, it was art. So we have to come at it in a different way than we come at many of the films that we see, although I have a history of picking somewhat gruesome films. Only because I choose them by the 14A trailers that they've been condensed to. But it seriously, this one was definitely art. And if we wanted to go back and find how it was compelled into being, we'd have to go back to the playwright because it was initially a theatrical piece. But it's not hard for us to wonder over the pain and the anger and the disconnection that would have created such a piece of art. The movie about a young man, Chiron, whose life is shown in three separate acts. You can see that, the theatrical residue of three acts in the movie. In the first part, he's a six-year-old kid. In the second, I don't know if he's six, he's a kid. In the second part, he's a teenager. In the third part, he's a young man. And the circumstances of his life are such that he's bullied, he's not safe at home, and he has to do what the trailer says, decide who he is in the midst of a world that rejects almost everything that he could name simply. And even something that in his context he's not able to name, but that speak to who he is at a very deep place. And so in the early part of the story, he runs into this guy who we've seen in the opening scene, is a drug dealer. And he's checking up on one of his guys who thanks him for the opportunity to deal for him. He's a crack dealer. And he rides around in this big old Cadillac that one reviewer said was filmed as though it was its own castle, its own palace. It had its own energy itself, the way the film was taken around it. And he's a big guy in the neighborhood, in those kinds of neighborhoods. It's an area of Miami that is historically black, looks a lot like what we saw in the film. And he sees Chiron as a kid being chased by these bullies from his class and hides in this like completely closed up apartment block. And Juan, who's the drug dealer, goes up and bangs in the window, the boards that had covered the window, and finds Chiron there and engages him. And it's not the kind of engagement that you would expect, because we all know what drug dealers are like, right? We all know that they prey on the weak, that they take advantage of those that come into their realm of influence, that they will make money for themselves and for those they give the opportunity to, at whatever cost. Their perspective on life is pretty bleak, but they find they can rise above some of that by being the big person on the block. And so when Juan saves Chiron from these bullies or tries to get him out of that space, we expect that there's not going to be a very nice thing that happens, that he's going to use Chiron for something. He's a little boy. He's got access that drug dealers don't have. He could do things for Juan. But in that scene, so early in the movie, we're introduced to this big guy who's like the king of his block, who is sweet and nice and takes Juan home with him, not to abuse him or not to indoctrinate him into some foul game, but to feed him and to shelter him. And because Chiron won't say anything, that's the only thing he could do. I mean, he couldn't take him home because Chiron wouldn't even say what his name was or where he lived. So you end up watching this unfold, this gift of time and place and security and safety by this person who we have absolutely no respect for because we live on this block. And we don't have to understand or survive or find our way on that block. The relationship with Juan develops throughout the movie, and you find out how complex it is. As Chiron's mom falls from being a personal support worker or something, she wears the scrubs that make her look like that, and that was her job, but she falls into crack use and addiction, and Juan's life turns from a hell to a darker kind of hell. And Juan accompanies him throughout that process. That relationship doesn't end. But he asks Juan questions, and Juan gives him answers, honest answers, and he carries him in this almost baptismal scene that you saw in the trailer, where he invites him to just rest back there, and you can do it. And he's a character that is a father figure to Chiron that he probably has never had. But Chiron knows, he knows that what Juan is doing is what is contributing to his own mother's disappearance before his very eyes, her disappearance into drug use and abuse and her consequent abuse of Chiron. So our invitation is to find our response to that. What is our response to that situation? A few years ago, I did a funeral for a young man who had Only God Can Judge Me tattooed across his chest. At 11 o'clock, he texted his mom to remind her that she needed to get him back into that. There's a special 12-week program that can finish your high school diploma. Not many people know about it, but it's a 12-week program that he had been in and he'd left, but he'd been accepted into a course to become a pastry chef at a local college. And if he didn't finish that 12 weeks, the acceptance was going to disappear. And so he texted his mom and said, "Don't forget to contact Mrs. So-and-so and make sure my name is back on the list." At 12:20, he was full of a whole bunch of bullets because he was in a house that was being charged for a drug bust in a drug bust, and he lay there dead. The dreams that he'd had were gone in half a second, and a life that you could almost touch, you could almost grab hold of, shattered into nothing. At the funeral, it's the only funeral I've ever used the F word in, but I needed the people who gathered there to know that they needed to grieve in their language, and so that's why I did it. But at the end of it, these tough people who had come up and lamented and shared their loss so graphically, I invited them to come up and get some flour smeared on their clothing because he wanted to be a pastry chef. And I didn't think any of them would do it because it's kind of like this kooky little ritual thing, and who wants to do that? But I said, I want this on your good clothes. I want the next time you see this in your closet, I want you to remember how fragile those dreams are and how close they are to shattering based on one or two little decisions. And every one of those big, ugly guys came forward and let me smear flour on their jackets. And the girls that were there who had mouthed such sorrow and such loss in such concrete and ghastly ways, let me smear it on them too. Scott and I watched a TED talk this week. A young prosecutor in the States in Boston called Adam Foss, some of you may have seen it on TED. He was studying law and he did his first placement working with a prosecutor in Boston. And the first few days he was on the job, he sat in courtrooms watching dozens and dozens of young black men, and some not so young, come back into that courtroom and say two words. They'd say not guilty. That's all they got to say. And the judge would make a decision based on a few things the prosecutor had said about what that person's life was going to be from there on. And they would go off into prison, disappear into the system. A system that Adam Foss said, if they get 1 year in prison, it's $106,000. $106,000 of an $80 billion industry in the United States. And he worked also in legal aid, working with the same kind of people at one point in his next placement after his next year at law school. And he decided, rather than being the pricey corporate lawyer that he dreamed of, having money galore, that he would become a prosecutor because he thought, this doesn't have to happen. And like, didn't I see that kid here? Like, didn't we invest $106,000 in putting him away? And what has that $106,000 got us? It got it back here a year and a half later. And what a lousy investment that is. So he decided that there were other ways that they could invest in kids in Boston. That didn't mean they just ended up in prison and didn't mean that they were just coming back year after year until they spent their entire lives virtually behind bars. Because systems and communities and stories and the stuff that compelled the art of moonlight into being, that happens. And wouldn't it be easier if we invested elsewhere? So Foss tells a story of one young man, Christopher, who ended up stealing a whole bunch of computers from Best Buy, 30 of them, had 30 felony charges against him. And as a prosecutor, this is like his first opportunity to do something. And he looks at the story of this guy who wanted to go to university but had so many ways that he couldn't get there that he stole the computers just to be able to pay for his tuition, and he got caught, right? And he said, well, I can put this guy in prison. I can put him away for 30 felony charges or one. I can let him go. I have his life in my hands. So they worked out a deal that this guy, Christopher, found 20 of the computers that he'd sold, and they bought them back, and they took them back to Best Buy, and the ones that they didn't get back, he worked off paying the money back to Best Buy, and he wrote an essay on the situation of his life and where he wanted to get, and he did community service hours. And 6 years later, Foss, who's sitting at a table eating sandwiches at some kind of an event, this guy comes over and throws his arm around him and gives him this big hug, and it's Christopher, 6 years after that date. A big bank somewhere. He'd finished school, and he was making more money than Foss would ever dream to make as a prosecutor. And he had a life. He had a life. So Foss now tells that story, and he was arrested as a kid on a drug charge. And walking down the street, like, the man has dreadlocks that go almost to his knees. Like, we'd write stories about him in our head in a second. We'd have all kinds of stories. Why do we press that moonlight glow on the stories of so many people and wash away all the color and leave it with a simple, single hue and judge them with that? Why do we do that? Can we not find, as Adam Foss did, can we not find those opportunities to press ourselves into a new way of understanding or a new way of thinking or a new way of offering our art to the world so that the reaction might be one of possibility, one of embrace, one of love, one of compassion, one of tomorrow, instead of just judging today? The things that have happened in Canada this week, the burning of the mosque and the standing up of so many Canadians to challenges that are happening in the States, show the worst of our nature and the best of our nature. And Alexander Solzhenitsyn says that line between good and evil lies right in our own hearts. We have the capacity for both. But I think that we sometimes don't even recognize the extent to which that evil side of our heart pumps strong and hard. And I think Moonlight helped me see that, because I don't see the full spectrum when I see. I have the same kind of color-sensitive and religion-sensitive glasses on that so many of my peers have. And so I invite you to help me remove those. Says the director of Moonlight and Chiron and Juan and Teresa and Paula, all the actors in that film, helped me do. And may we find ways to go beyond the spectrum of hatred and racism and judgmentalism and assumption, and find our way toward the full spectrum, the kaleidoscope of what life may be, and invite ourselves to it, invite our community to it, invite the world to it. That's what our hearts are for. And that's what the line down the middle of them is for. It's to remind us of those two sides and to encourage us to make sure that one beats stronger and harder in every situation. We're going to go and have lunch after the service, but I'm going to invite you to come back in here. Just because of the time, I'm not going to do a Q&A now, but I'm going to invite you to come back in here to have conversation about the movie, if you want to do that. Those of you who have seen it, and those of you who haven't, to just hear what the impact on others has been. I know that was a great part of last week, was the opportunity to engage. So do that. The chairs move around, and we can have some good conversations based on that, or you can have conversations based on anything you want, seriously. But if you want to talk about the movie, this is your opportunity too. So thank you. I was going to read my focus moment again as Scott played some music. Under the circumstance of moonlight, red disappears first. Yellow is gone. And green turns to shades of gray or ripples into a black no conifer has ever been. I know it's green. I know the birdhouse swinging from its branch is red. I know the finches gathered early at the feeder are yellow, dulled as they are in winter's plumes. Still, as I gaze upon a changed and blue-lit world, I hold these truths within me. So why is it I cannot hold to other truths that time to time are hidden too by circumstance, that casts them in this same and changing light, flattening the spectrum,
from multi-hued and wondrous to a cold and hard insistent blue? Why can I not see beauty still in hearts grown cold, or dreams that withered long ago? Why am I so quick to see the depth of anger in this circumstantial light, and not the love that spoke just yesterday, or the invitation that might take me back to wonder? Why do I insist the moonlight prism that robs him and her and him of the miracle of childish wonder, of youth and hope and wants to be, is the truth that stands before me? We were all wonder once, riding the chariots of our father's arms by day, braving the night, safe twixt the castles of our mother's breasts. We cast the trees as our companions and bade them witness our grandest schemes. We yearned for affirmation, and it bent and teased our being toward its singular hue, the kaleidoscopes that once defined us bleeding out, till all is lit like moonlight, and it's cold and hard, insistent blue. Don't forget. Don't forget. Go in peace. Thank you.
You have been listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to www.westhill.net/donate.